Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 102. I'm recording it on Monday, February 23rd, 2009. The PE10 level today is 13. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for this podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com site. The title of this particular selection is Bama Country. The title of the podcast is Financial Responsibility Breaks Down When Passive Investing Becomes Popular. I'm a little stirred up because there's a fellow who I don't know if I have the name exactly right. Is it Rick Sintelli? I believe it's Rick Sintelli. I believe he's a journalist at the maybe CN. One of the financial. I don't know if it's. I'm thinking CNBC, but I may have that wrong. Maybe NBC or he has some. There's some clip of him, and I think it was featured on the Drudge Report. And he was on the stock exchange, and he was saying we need a tea party. He was basically objecting to the Obama administration. I think in particular the thing he was objecting to is the proposal that has come out to help people who are not able to cover their mortgages. And he was saying, we need financial responsibility, and I shouldn't have to pay. How many of you, and he would stand up and he'd say, how many of you want to pay your neighbor's mortgage? You know, this nation is founded on the idea that when you sign a contract, you honor it. You signed a contract to pay your mortgage. You either pay the mortgage or you lose the house. And we shouldn't be taking money from the good guys, the guys who honor their responsibilities, and paying it over to the people who do not honor their responsibilities. It's sort of a populist argument, although it's a sort of a funny kind of populism, because I don't know, it also would be a populist argument to help people pay their mortgages. So it's sort of a reverse populism. It's a populism for anti-populist, I suppose. But it's a sensitive question. But there's a lot of people who agree with this, and after he said it, it's gotten a lot of play. And after he said it, there was a write-up at the Frugal Dad blog about it, and I have great respect for the author of the Frugal Dad blog, and the Frugal Dad blog author very much agreed with it, although he didn't agree with some of the harsh language that this fellow used, Rick Sintelli. But he agreed with the message, and a lot of people that wrote into the blog agreed, and I did not really agree, and I want to explain why, and I've come up with a little mental exercise that I'm going to work through to help explain why I think this guy is on the wrong track. Now, before I even start, I agree strongly with the basic principle. The basic principle being put forward is we all should honor our word, especially in financial dealings, in all kinds of dealings. I think we should honor our word, but especially in financial dealings. So, yes, he's absolutely right that the fabric of the society is torn apart if people don't honor their obligations. If you sign a mortgage, it has to mean something. You can't say, oh, I signed it, when things were going good, and now things are going not so hot, and now I want my friends and neighbors to bail me out. And it's true, of course. Some of the things they'll bring up is that some of the people who can't handle their mortgages, they've spent their money on other things. They spent their money on boats or vacations or whatever it is. And a lot of the people being asked to bail them out through increased taxes have been prudent. They've saved their money. So why should they have to, they've been hurt too. in the financial crash, why should they have to give up the money they saved through their hard work and through their thrift and their prudence and bail out people who were less responsible? So the root argument is solid as solid can be. But that's the problem, frankly, in my opinion. The argument is too strong. You know, the reaction I have to an argument like this is, who could possibly disagree with this? But of course, there are people that disagree with it. There's the Obama administration is pushing legislation through in conflict with this idea, and the Obama administration has a high approval rating in these polls they take. Not that I'm a big fan of polls, but they mean something. Obama was elected, you know. As he said in one of these, you know, there was one of these discussions about his stimulus plan, and he said, well, I won, you know, he won, you know, fair and square, he won the vote. So, you know, you sort of have to ask, well, there's two things this could mean. One, We really are a nation of people that believe in financial responsibility, in which case, where did all these Obama supporters come from? Are they aliens? You know, how did they get here? How's he win all these polls? How's he win these elections? Or we really don't, you know, they really are the majority, and that means we really don't support financial responsibility, which I find more than a little unbelievable. I think the answer is, if you talk to the people who support this, I'm not making a case as to whether the mortgage, I don't even know what's in it. I don't even know. I haven't studied it. Don't know. I think probably in some cases there is a need for some government involvement there, but whether it's being done properly, I am not taking any position at all. I'm completely neutral. It's just, in order for me to give an intelligent assessment, I would need to study the particulars. And, you know, I have too many things on my plate to do that. And I don't think I need to study the particulars in order to address the bigger question, which is what I'm addressing in this podcast. But I reject out of hand the idea that everyone who supports this mortgage assistance rejects the idea of financial responsibility. I find that idea offensive. I wish, you know, I'd love to get in a debate with this. I don't know his exact name. Is it Rick Santelli? I hope I have it right. I would love to debate the guy. You know, with total respect, because I think he's making an important point. I certainly don't think his point is poorly taken, and you know, I admire him for making it. Great, you know, great thing. He's put it on the table. We need to discuss this. It's an issue. It's an important issue. And there is a risk that we're undermining financial responsibility. The point is well taken. But the suggestion is that a large segment of our population has rejected the idea of financial responsibility. And that I do not buy. Partly I don't buy it just because it's too dark a thing to buy into. You know, in other words, I don't want to buy it. Part of it is I just don't want to buy it. But part of it is I genuinely do not buy it. I haven't studied this, but I've seen a couple people debate this. And, you know, you'll get an Obama supporter to defend the idea, and they're not really defending. You know, they are saying that people need help. But the best argument I think I saw, and it was Chris Matthews, and this was not he wouldn't even call it an argument. It was just an offhand observation. But I think he was debating Rick Santelli, and I saw this. And he said, you know, Chris Matthews is a liberal television commentator. He has some television show, Hardball, I think it's called. He was an aide, I believe, in Congress at one time. On the Democratic side. I don't recall who he was an aide for. Tip O'Neill. I think it was Tip O'Neill. I think I read a book by Chris Matthews along. I think his book was called Hardball. That was a long time ago. But, you know, Chris Matthews, he was like in a little exchange there with this Rick Santelli. And he didn't really dispute what Rick Santelli said. But then he just said, well, doing nothing is not an option. And that's the answer. you know, it's real easy. What's, you know, something again, and again, this offends me. See, this is sort of a double dose of offending Rob Bennett. You know, certain arguments just offend me. I don't really get off too much on the left versus right stuff. I see some good sometimes on different sides, but there are certain arguments that get under my skin. And one thing that gets under my skin is, say Obama didn't put this forward. What would Rick Santelli be saying then? Then he'd be saying, oh, Obama's not doing anything. Yeah, we got this crisis. Solve the crisis. So he's doing something, and they're slamming him. And it's like, what is your idea? And again, I am not defending the proposal. Please do not understand. I am not saying this is a good proposal. I honestly do not know. I think something should be done, but I'm not willing to say it's been done proper. I don't know. I'm not willing to say it's improper either, but I am offended that people would come along and sort of, you know, they weren't just criticizing. I mean, they were ridiculing. And the question is, what do you propose, Rick Santelli? That's what I want to know. What do you propose? And this is the whole political dynamic. You know, the big thing in the presidential election was change. You know, the idea was, there's a feeling in the country that we're on the wrong track. And that feeling is even stronger now than it was during the election. But the feeling was that Bush did not respond to these problems. And so now Obama's being given a chance, and the public is generally supportive at this point because they want to give him a chance, and they don't feel it's been long enough to say it's been a chance yet. But do I think he's doing all the right things? No, because I think the problem is passive investing. You know what I think. But the reality is, the passive investing problem became a crisis in 1995 when stock prices went to insanely dangerous levels. And Bill Clinton didn't do anything about it for 95, 96, 97, 98, 99. That's 5 years. George Bush didn't do anything for it for 8 years. So it's a bipartisan problem. And Obama hasn't done anything for 2 months or whatever it is, but 6 weeks. But maybe he will. We'll see. We'll see. But I want to start with a mental exercise, because I think it helps to take yourself out of the problem we have is that, you know, conservatives are just jumping in and to their conservative ideology. And saying, well, government, you know, Obama's using a government solution, so that's bad. That's against our ideology. That's bad. So we got to oppose this. And liberals are doing the same thing. Liberals are saying, oh, well, the conservatives are recommending free market solutions, and we don't like free market solutions, so we prefer government, so this solution's good. Whether it's actually good or not. It's ideology talking. And that's a sign that we're not serious yet. Frankly, I think it's a sign things aren't bad enough yet. I hate to say it, but the problem is when we get good and scared, we'll drop all this childishness and we'll get serious about the problem. And I think that's what the vast majority of the public wants to see. Both Democrats and Republicans, that's what they want to see. And that's not what they're seeing. So I want to run through a mental exercise that I hope will illustrate why I think a lot of people have a hard time believing that passive investing is the whole problem. I remember Drip Guy back at the Goon Central board, and I, you know, I would raise these ideas, and he would just say, Rob, everything's passive investing to you. You know, I haven't read anybody else say that the whole problem is passive investing. Well, maybe, you know, I don't think that's quite true. There are people who have suggested that the problem is the efficient market theory and the problem is passive investing. But no one, I don't think, has developed the idea to the extent that I have in the podcast and in the articles at the site. I think that is true. But that's just, you know, coincidence. I mean, it's just because I happen to be in a position where, you know, I've had personal life experiences that show me, you know, just how big the passive investing problem is. But certainly Robert Shiller makes the case in his book, Irrational Exuberance, that policymakers need to get involved when the stock market becomes insanely overpriced. He argues that in the conclusion to the book. And he predicts exactly what happened. He said, we may suffer losses equal to the size of all the farms in the country, or all the schools in the country, or even all the houses in the country. Well, obviously, if we're going to suffer losses equal to the loss of all the houses in the country, we're going to have a major recession, if not a depression. So Robert Shiller was certainly aware of this years ago. This is nothing new. So the problem is not, you know, it's true that not many people are developing the idea, but that's mainly because the idea today doesn't have political support. In other words, if Obama thought that doing something about passive investing would be politically popular, he'd be doing it. And if the Republicans thought that doing something about passive investing were politically popular, they would have done it during the past 8 years. So it's not being talked about because it doesn't favor anyone's ideology. It doesn't favor Republicans. Passive investing isn't a Republican idea or a Democratic idea. It's a dumb idea. That's all. It's just a dumb idea. I'd love to see, you know, I sometimes think it's a good thing that it's not a partisan idea, because in theory, the Republicans and Democrats could join together and push it together, and we wouldn't have these ideological disputes. But the other side of the story is that with neither party pushing it, it doesn't go forward. So the reason Drip Guy's not hearing about it every day is there's no one sees a political advantage in pointing to the real problem. The political advantage is in, you know, for the Democrats pushing through programs that increase the size of the government, and for Republicans opposing that, trying to score political points by opposing it. The reality, in Rob Bennett's opinion, is as long as passive investing remains popular and it remains the dominant investing model today, as long as it remains popular, it will be impossible for us to make sense of stock investing or of economics, or, you know, to plan our future, our financial future, or even to make sense of politics to a large extent. The errors, the destruction that comes about because of this investing model is so great that it dwarfs everything else. It just overwhelms everything else. So that's what I want to run through. Now, the mental exercise is, imagine that instead of what passive investing does is it says you don't have to pay attention to price. It says, you know, when they say you can't time the market, what they're saying is don't let it worry your pretty little head that stocks are valued at 3x fair value. Just, you know, stocks are always a good buy. You don't have to look at price. Ignore price. Don't pay attention to it. Timing doesn't work. Stocks for the long run. Buy and hold. You know the routine. What if we applied that same thinking to car buying instead of stock buying? Somebody put out a book called Cars for the Long Run, and all the experts got behind it, and there were magazines, you know, Money Magazine would say, we've got a new way to buy cars, a new super way, and it's going to change everything. We're never again going to ask about the price of cars. Don't ask about the price of cars. Cars are always good to buy. What would this do? What would this do for the economy? Now, in the early days, the damage would not be that great. It's obviously a dumb idea. You know, I hope I don't have to explain that. It's the dumbest idea imaginable. But this is exactly what we do in the stock field. When we tell people not to time the market, what we're telling them is don't pay attention to price. It's the dumbest idea imaginable. But say that we did it. What would it do to our economy? In the early days, it wouldn't do that much damage. Because if you say you just did it by a law, you know, you said you can't ask about price and the car manufacturers can't tell you the price. Car companies have spent years developing cars. And so the cars are high quality, and they're used to selling them at a certain price. So probably for a year or two, things would remain pretty much as they've always been. We get a good deal on our cars today in the United States. Car companies produce good cars, and they sell them at reasonable prices. And that would just continue to be the case. And so, you know, if you were looking for an instant reaction to this law or whatever it is that made us go crazy in the subject of cars, you wouldn't see it. If you only look for a year or two or three to see what the reaction was, your conclusion would be, didn't really seem to do any damage. You know, looking at the price of cars doesn't really seem to make any difference. Companies still produce good cars. They still charge reasonable prices. No biggie. Over time, however, and see, this is what fools people. Passive investing did not destroy us in the first year or the second year or the third year. At the time passive investing first became popular, stocks were you know, wildly underpriced. The book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, popularized passive investing. I believe that book came out around 1974, 73, somewhere around then. And stock prices were just incredibly low. From 1975 through 1995, rational investors would have been going with 70, 80% stock allocations. Stocks were a wonderful buy when passive investing first became popular and remained a wonderful buy for two decades. It wasn't until 1995 when prices became insanely dangerous and when passive investing took over. See, rational investors and passive investors did the same thing all of those years. It's only in 95 when the passive investors split off and began investing in crazy, insane, irresponsible, reckless ways, and the rational investors lowered their stock allocations because prices were so dangerous. They wanted to preserve their portfolios. That's where the split occurred. So in the early years, no damage because prices remained low. And the same thing would happen if passive investing of cars were to catch on. There would be no damage. But now think what would happen over time. All companies in the United States, we live in a competitive society, right? This is our free market system. So all of the companies, they have meetings, you know, the top executives have meetings, and they'd be saying, well, you know, whatever it is, Ford, we want to beat Chrysler, and Chrysler wants to beat GM and all this sort of thing. And they'd say, well, what can we do to get an edge? Is there anything anybody can think of? And someone would say, well, I've noticed, you know, some up-and-comer, some guy who wants to rise to the top, he'd put together a presentation. He'd work nights and weekends and put it together and present it to his bosses. He'd say, you know, can I have the floor? I have an idea. And they'd say, sure, let's, you know, go to it. And he'd stand up and he'd have a slideshow and all this thing. And he'd say, look, you know what works? Selling cars. Marketing. And he'd put up some slides and he'd say, when we spend millions and millions of dollars on marketing, do you know what happens? We sell more cars. It works. And they'd say, well, yeah, you know, we knew that. You know, you don't get a promotion for that one. He'd say, no, I understand we know that. But listen to the clincher. In the past, we haven't really been willing to spend. You know, I'll just make up a number. Let's say for the average car that sells for $20,000, $3,000 of the cost of the car goes to marketing. I have no idea what the number is. Let's just say that had been true. So the guy would say, okay, in the past, $3,000. He'd say, what if starting tomorrow, we spend not $3,000 per car on marketing for a $20,000 car, but we spend $20,000. We increase marketing by 6-7 times. Think we'd sell a whole bunch more cars? Think we grab a whole bunch more market share? And they'd look at them and they'd say, are you nuts? We sell this car for $20,000 and you're going to spend $20,000 on marketing? That would mean we'd have to increase the price of the car to almost $40,000. Are you loco? He'd say, sure. In the old world, that was true. We'd have to increase the price to $40,000 and that would hurt sales, but it's not going to hurt sales today. We don't ever reveal the price. The customers don't ever ask the price. We live in a world of cars for the long run. Customers know not to ask about price. We can, in the old days, there was a penalty for spending $20,000 on marketing. The penalty was nobody would buy your car. We would have gone bankrupt if we tried such a crazy thing. But that's not true today. The customers have no way of knowing. We just take the money out of their accounts. They're not allowed to ask how much they're paying, and we're not allowed to tell them. Cars for the long run. We get the market share. We get rich. And the customers pay the bill. And hey, what if we don't do it? You know, somebody would raise their hand and say, look, yeah, you're right. That does sound like that would work. But listen, buddy, that's unethical. You're gonna sell people a car and you're gonna charge them $40,000 and $20,000 if it's going to marketing? Buddy, I don't want to be associated. You're a con man. I don't want to be associated with this. I'll say, fine. Take your high ethical position. But you don't think there's somebody, here we are at the Ford meeting, you don't think there's somebody over at Chrysler coming up with the same idea as we speak? You don't think there's someone at GM coming up with the same idea as we speak? If we don't do it, they're going to do it. And how are we going to compete? How are we going to compete when we're spending $3,000 per car on marketing and they're spending $20,000? How are we going to sell our cars? How are we going to meet our mortgages? How are we going to feed our families? How are we going to send our kids to college? You see, we live in a competitive society. We think of that as a good thing. It's competition that has made this country what it is. I sound like a politician now. But, you know, competition is healthy. Competition, when it's done properly, competition's a wonderful thing. It makes us all better. It makes us all richer. Because each person is doing the best he or she can, and we're all obtaining benefits from the good work being done by all the others. That's the beauty of competition. It's a wonderful thing. You know, when all the rock and roll groups are competing to get in the top 10, we get a year where, you know, Stop in the Name of Love comes out, and then 2 weeks later, Mrs. Robinson, and 2 weeks later, Hey Jude, and 2 weeks later, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, and 2 weeks later, Pleasant Valley Sunday, and it's bam, 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 bam. Competition is good. And of course, that's the argument that all the free market people are making. They're saying, well, we need competition, we need free market. But what they're missing is competition has to be grounded in some sort of rationality. Take away the rationality and you turn competition from a powerful force for good into a powerful force for evil. Take away the competition in the car market. Pass a law where people can't ask price and people can't consider price, people can't tell price, and you're going to have a car market where a $40,000 car, $20,000 the expense goes to marketing. And it doesn't matter how ethical the people are, they have no choice. We're going to be driven to it. Now, Say that we lived in this world, and Ford came up with this idea, and of course, what would happen is Ford would adopt this idea, and then of course, a year later, Chrysler's going to find out why their car sales are dramatically down, and they're going to increase their marketing from $3,000 per car to $20,000, and they're going to increase the cost of their cars from twenty to $40,000. So now, a few years ago, before Cars for the Long Run came out, we were all paying $20,000 for a car we're now paying $40,000 for. And of course, you know, a few years down the road, it's not going to be $40,000, it's going to be $80,000. And then it's going to be $160,000. There is no limit. If you're going to stay alive in this competitive society, there will come a time when they'll be spending $100,000 a car on marketing cars. There's no benefit to anyone. It doesn't make the cars safer. It doesn't make the cars cleaner. It doesn't make the cars sportier. It doesn't make the engines run better. It doesn't improve the gas mileage. But it's a competitive advantage. As long as there's no cost associated with it, you might as well spend all your money on marketing and have the customer foot the bill. The only thing that keeps car companies honest is the fact that customers consider price. I've just summed up in that sentence the entire economic crisis that we're dealing with today. I'm going to say it again, like Linda Ronstadt did. The only thing that keeps car companies honest is that their customers care about price. You get it? Well, in the stock selling industry, 30 years of passive investing has taught us all not to care about price. Therefore, the entire stock selling industry is dishonest. They're not dishonest in the sense that they're bad people and they wake up in the morning thinking how they can screw us over. They're just like the people in the car selling industry. They want to do good. They want to help us. But to stay alive, they can't give good advice. Good advice has been made, essentially, it's been made illegal by the promotion of passive investing. This bad advice drives out good advice. If you're trying to sell stocks and the guy across the street is appealing to people's lowest, most base instincts, the get-rich-quick impulse that says you don't have to care about price, you can't compete. You're out of business if you tell the truth about stock investing. That's a problem because there's so much money in this country going through stocks. Trillions. All of our retirement money is tied up in it. So you pollute the stock selling industry and you eventually bring the country to its knees. It takes time. It didn't happen overnight. Random Walk Down Wall Street was published in 74. You know, it's now 2009. It took time. But it was inevitable that it was going to happen unless somebody stepped in. If responsible people had stepped in, it wouldn't have happened. But unless responsible people step in and do something about it, it's inevitable. And of course, history tells us just that. If you look at the history of the market in the United States, you will see there have been four times we've bought into this insane idea that the price of stocks shouldn't affect our stock allocation. And each of those four times we have suffered an economic crisis in the years following. A serious economic crisis. I don't know about, the first one was in the early 20th century, the early years of the 20th century, and that's so long ago, I just don't know the history. But I know that the drop in stock prices was roughly 68%, so my guess is there was a serious economic crisis. But I just have never read anything about it. The second time we tried this insane idea was the 1920s. And the result of that was the Great Depression. Highest unemployment rate in the history of the country. The third time we tried it was the mid-1960s. The result of that was the stagflation of the 70s. Carter had a failed presidency because of the popularity of passive investing in the 1960s. Richard Nixon was removed from office largely because of the popularity of passive investing and the economic crisis that brought on. And then in the 90s, passive investing became popular and we're now suffering a huge recession that may become the second depression. You can't popularize the idea that the price you pay for stocks doesn't matter without destroying the economy of the United States. It can't be done. Because we need stocks. And if there's no limit on the price in a competitive society, all the money of the economy is ultimately going to flood into that one place where it's all being wasted. It's all going down a sewer. But there's like a magnet pulling all the resources of the country in that direction. Just think what would happen. If nobody ever stepped in and did anything about this cars for the long run thing. We need cars. We'd soon be spending $100,000 per car instead of 20. And think of how all the resources we'd have to stop sending our kids to school or stop medical treatment or stop going on vacations. And that would cause all those businesses to fail. It would cause the vacation industry to fail and the medical industry to fail and the education industry to fail. The money's got to come from somewhere. We only have so much in the way of resources. And if we're going to put all our money into advertising on cars, which we must, unless we're willing to acknowledge that we should be looking at price, we're going to sink the entire economy. What would happen in this cars for the long run scenario? If, say, there was some company that came along and said, I'm going to spill the beans. You know, I'm going to be a startup and I'm going to make a car. I'm going to go back to the old way of making cars. I'm only going to spend $3,000 on marketing and I'm going to sell a car for $20,000. And these other guys can keep trying to sell it for $100,000, but I have a feeling this $20,000 car that's just as good or better is going to catch on. See, the quality of the cars would also decline. Because when the companies are making these profits, selling a car for $100,000, they're going to care less and less about quality. Because you don't have to compete on quality anymore. In a world in which no one looks at price, no one looks at quality. The cars would become worse and worse and worse over time. Because, say, if any car company that cared about quality, the competitor would drive him out of business by spending more on marketing. He would get killed. The only thing that stops all the money from being sucked into marketing is the fact that people care about price. That's the break. That's what makes the free market work. The free market, the beauty of it is the feedback mechanism. The producers are getting feedback from the consumers. But the feedback comes in the way of decisions. The consumers are assessing value propositions. They're saying, we do care about marketing, and marketing does influence us. But the problem is, if a company spends too much on marketing, we're going to say, wait a minute, that car costs twice as much as the other one. It's not that much better. I don't care, you know, they've got Tiger Woods on their commercials, but... And I like Tiger Woods, but I'm not going to spend $20,000 more just because they've got Tiger Woods in their commercials. The company would go out of business. So competition is not just on marketing. It's on quality, and it's on price. It's on reputation, all these things. But throw price out the window, which is what we've done when passive investing became popular, and you throw value assessments out the window. It becomes impossible for the consumer to determine what cars are worth buying and what cars are not worth buying. The very word worth, when I use the sentence worth buying, worth means a good deal for the money. But passive investors don't look at whether they're getting a good deal for the money. Passive investors buy stocks all the time. That's the thing they're passive about. If a company came in and tried to produce a good car under this, you know, this crazy scenario, but no crazier than what we've done in stocks, if a company tried to produce a good car at a good price, you know what these people would do? They would go to Congress and they would lobby to put them out of business. They'd pass laws saying, you can't have somebody producing a car at a fair price anymore. Maybe in the old days, fine. We were happy in the old days when there was none of this cars for the long run stuff. That was all fine and good. But now we're producing cars for $100,000 and this guy's putting it out for $20,000. Now we used to do that too. And if we didn't have to spend $80,000 on marketing, we'd be happy to do it. But in this competitive environment we're in, we've got to spend $80,000 on marketing. There's a couple guys tried not to, and they're out of business. We need legislation forbidding anyone from making a quality car for $20,000. That's an outrage. We need our Congress to take action here. See, that's the sort of thing people are starting to complain about now. They're saying, oh, we don't like it now that financial irresponsibility is being rewarded. We should allow the people who saved and were thrifty and were prudent, we should give them a chance. We shouldn't take all their money and direct it to the people who were imprudent. Well, it's a little late for that now. The entire nation has been imprudent from 1974 forward. How many times have you heard the phrase, stocks for the long run? How many times have you heard the phrase, timing doesn't work? How many times have you heard the phrase, buy and hold? How many times have you heard the phrase, stay the course? And now we're going to talk about financial responsibility? Tell me how that stuff can work. Tell me how it could ever work not to consider the price of the stocks you buy. Answer me that question, and then we'll talk about financial responsibility. I'm no expert, okay? Don't claim to be one. I'm a reporter. I'm a reporter who checked out the retirements, the studies that we all use to plan our retirements, and I found that they are analytically invalid. They get all the numbers wrong. And I reported this at a Motley Fool discussion board in May of 2002. These studies are called old school safe withdrawal rate studies. For retirements beginning in January of 2000, these studies say that a 4% withdrawal rate is 100% safe. 100% safe. That's what all my friends were being told at my discussion board. I checked the numbers. You know what the real number is? Those retirements have a 30% chance of surviving. 30%. They're called safe withdrawal rates. But there's a 2 in 3 chance they're going to go bust if stocks perform in the future, anything at all as they always have in the past. Those are the realities. Undisputed. No one has ever argued that valuations don't affect long-term returns. John Bogle hasn't argued it. Bill Bernstein hasn't argued it. Scott Burns hasn't argued it. John Graney hasn't argued it. Mel Lindauer hasn't argued it. Taylor Larimore hasn't argued it. What they've done is they have banned it. They've prohibited the discussion. They've said, you can't tell people the real numbers for planning their retirements. In a world in which we're giving them numbers from La La Land, you're making us look bad, Rob. Come on. We're telling them it's 100% safe to put their money into something that is almost certainly going to fail, and you're going to start giving the real numbers now? It's a little late, buddy. If you wanted to give accurate retirement numbers, you should have did it back before the book A Random Walk Down Wall Street was published. You're a little late to the party. We're in the stocks for the long run mode. We can't go back to giving reasonable investing advice. It's too late for that. Scott Burns, Dallas Morning News columnist, said, the reason the media would not report the safe withdrawal rate numbers accurately is, quote, it is information most people don't want to hear. People don't want to hear that they've been paying $100,000 for a car that only costs $20,000 to produce. It makes them feel like fools. It makes them look like idiots. Why did they do that? The point I'm making here is the title of the podcast, Financial Responsibility Breaks Down When Passive Investing Becomes Popular. Passive investing is not an investing theory. It is a disease. What passive investing, it's not an idea. It's not an idea. There is no rationale for it. There never has been one. This is why people get so angry. Because there's a pose that there's some sort of argument for passive investing or some kind of historical data or some sort of study, academic study, that supports it. There never has been any such thing. There never can be any such thing. Passive investing is an emotional impulse. We all have a get-rich-quick impulse within us. Every single blessed one of us. Democrats, Republicans, Independents. All of us. And we're talking about what we're all doing is we've destroyed our economy because we allowed this emotional impulse to take over the world of investing advice. Bad investing advice drives out good investing advice. There are lots of people who have been trying to tell the truth about stock investing for a long time now. You've heard me give the litany of names so many times, I'm sick of saying it. But there are scores of people who've been trying to warn us for years now that this is a bad idea. A wretchedly bad idea. And there's two things that happens to them. What happened to me was I was literally prohibited from speaking. What usually happens is they're put in a ghetto. They'll say, oh, you want to tell the truth about safe withdrawals? Well, you go off to a bear board. You go to a bear board. We don't allow those kind of people in this board. This isn't a bear board. So they're put away in a little ghetto, and nobody hears what they say. You know, 10% of investors who are rational, you know, they hear it. But the 90%, most of us, don't get to hear the message. Or if we hear it, you know, there's some little mention made of it. But you can't start a thread. You can't discuss it at any depth or any, you know. There's just somebody will say somewhere, oh, I think valuations might affect long-term returns. They'll say, oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sure it does. Valuations affect long-term returns. Now, about that passive investing study. Wow, isn't that interesting? Aren't we smart? Aren't we great? The people who need to hear about the flaws of passive investing are the people who follow passive investing, not the bear boards. They already get it. They know. What we need to do is to take the things that the people on the bear boards know and report it to the people that aren't on bear boards, the people who are putting their 401k money into stocks and need to know how stock investing works in the real world. But you see, you can't, as a practical matter, we can't expect, you know, Morningstar or Motley Fool or IndexUniverse.com or Bogleheads.org to permit honest posting on valuations until everybody permits honest posting on valuations. Because if only the one permits it, they're going to get the passive investing dogmatist angry as hornets. Because when you report accurately what the historical data says, it makes them look like fools. We have to deal with that. And now we're at the point where we're getting angry at the people who are saying help the people who, you know, who are losing their homes. Now, should the people who bought the mortgages have been responsible? Well, of course. Of course. You know, it's so obviously true what Rick Santelli is saying that, it's insulting to even respond. It insults our intelligence that the idea that some of us don't understand that people should be responsible when they take out a mortgage. But this is where we're going to start. You know, I remember when I lived in Arlington, they had day laborers. There were certain places you'd be driving to work and you'd see them, and they'd be, you know, I don't know if they were, illegal immigrants or legal immigrants. I don't know, but they'd be standing there, hoping to get a job for the day. These are the kind of people that we're talking about. I mean, we're talking about all kinds of people, but a lot of them. You know, part of the idea in the United States is You come to this country with, you know, nothing on your back, and you can build a life for yourself if you work hard. And these, I think it'd be fair to say, these people work hard. But there's a big difference, and I'm going to say there's a big difference between these day laborers that I used to pass and the Rick Santellis of the world. And I don't mean that as a dig at Rick Santelli. I'm sure he works hard at his job. He did a good job. He brought an important matter to our attention. So it's not a dig. But my point is, these guys, if these guys get a brick in the wrong place, you know, they're likely to get balled out. If they get two bricks in the wrong place on the same day, they lose their jobs. That's not the way it works at the level where Rick Santelli operates and where I used to operate in the corporate world. It's not how it works at the level where John Bogle operates and Bill Bernstein. The mistake here, if anybody's going to, you know, I don't think it's right to lay this on anyone. It's not right to lay it on John Bogle, because he's a victim of this impulse as much as the rest of us are. He's a victim of the community telling him, cheering him on. He had millions cheering him on. And that influences one's thinking. But Bogle at least has the millions in the bank. And I think it'd be fair to say his mistake was a lot bigger than any mistake made by one of these day laborers. So these, you know, what happens is these people work their hearts out. And we all know that's not true in every single case. But we all know the other's not true in every single case either. That's what we're talking about here. The reason why there is public sympathy for people who can't pay their mortgages is everyone who's honest about it knows there are some people out there who have worked darn hard for those houses. They're trying to get in at the low level. They're buying starter homes. They're trying to get their piece of the American dream. And it's being taken away from them. That's why we're sympathetic. Not because we don't believe in financial responsibility. The point is, financial responsibility doesn't start with day laborers. It starts with the big shot investing advisors who got it wrong. Got it wrong big time. Let's start there. You know, if we're going to start talking about financial responsibility, let's start there. With the people with the big educations and the big paychecks and the big portfolio accounts. Now, before I get too carried away in that direction, you've heard me say before, I don't believe in hanging anybody from a tree. I have said many times, I think it's a waste of energy, all this anger that's being directed at Bernie Madoff. And Bernie Madoff is, if you're going to select anybody as a bad guy, you know, he's everybody's bad guy. But I don't think it solves the problem. The Bernie Madoff story, you know, people, oh, there was somebody the other day, and I don't even understand exactly what he said, but somebody at bogleheads.org, and he said Madoff hadn't even made any trades for years. You know, it's like the money was just sort of sitting there, and he wasn't even buying any securities at all. In other words, the whole thing was just a Potemkin village? And I don't know the details. I don't care. It's not my issue. My issue is this other thing. But the point the guy was making is the Bernie Madoff thing is so unbelievable. You know, this is the point I want to make with this podcast. People are looking for explanations for the economic crisis. And they're looking at all these petty things. They're saying, oh, the problem is greedy bankers. Or the problem is Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Or the problem is Obama. Or the problem is Bush. Or the problem is, you know, who knows what. And all of those things, you know, maybe they're a tiny little piece of it. And I'm sure Bush didn't do everything right. And I'm sure Obama's not going to do everything right. And I'm sure that there are greedy bankers. And I'm sure that Bernie Madoff did do some things wrong. But the point, the problem is not the individuals. The problem is the environment in which they operated that let this get so out of hand. And that environment is called passive investing. It has a name. Let's start calling it by its name. The problem wasn't Bernie Madoff, and we know that for a fact because there was a fellow who wrote a memo, a fellow who wasn't even a regulator. He was just like a regular guy like I am, smarter, you know, but same basic idea. And he wrote this long memo, 17-page memo to the SEC saying what Bernie Madoff did, was claiming to do, was mathematically impossible. He said this guy can't be legit. And the SEC took it up, and they went in and checked it out, and they said he's okay. So it's not a problem that we don't have government regulations. The government checked the guy out. The problem is, I don't know why the SEC approved it, but again, it's got to be the environment in which they operated. And of course the answer is, say they had shut Bernie Madoff down. Would it have accomplished anything? In the grand scheme of things, you're talking about a drop of water in the Atlantic Ocean compared to what the promotion of passive investing did to us. That's the problem. That's where most of us have our retirement money. In 401ks, where we're putting money in without paying attention to valuations. That's been going on a daily basis for 30 years. That's where all the money went. There's a small number that have money in with Bernie Madoff. It's a tiny number in the grand scheme of things. And if the SEC guy had said, "Yeah, this whole thing is fraud," is he going to stop there? What do you want him to do exactly? You want him to shut Bernie Madoff down? Do you want him to shut down the U.S. stock market? Well, the U.S. stock market in January of 2000 was valued at 3 times fair value. Is that not a Ponzi scheme just as much as Bernie Madoff was a Ponzi scheme? Is this SEC regulator going to shut down the U.S. stock market? You know, everybody wants him to blow the whistle on Bernie Madoff, but they don't want him to blow the whistle on the S&P 500. What's the difference? The difference is the S&P 500 cost us a lot more money, wiped out millions more people. All Ponzi schemes are bad. It's not just ones with the name Bernie Madoff on them that are bad. They're all bad. What we should be looking for are stock transactions that have substance to them. But guess what you have to have substance? You've got to have a populace that cares about price. We are the regulators. You know, the SEC gets involved. They're the regulators of last resort. They're the people that come in when everything else fails. That's all they can do. They can't regulate every transaction. They can't follow you around and check if you ever put money into the market and make sure it's all legit. They're there to handle the rare case. The problem here isn't the rare case. The problem is the everyday case. We were putting money into a dangerous stock market and nobody was but 90% of the experts were telling us it wasn't dangerous. 90% of the experts were telling us what we wanted to hear, not what we needed to hear. And they were doing that because we were putting so much pressure on them not to shoot straight. It's a circle. It's a community problem. You can't pull out one individual and say, you should have behaved differently. Because anyone who behaved differently was going to get his or her head cut off. And most of us don't want to have our heads cut off. So if we want to solve the problem, yes, financial responsibility has to be part of it, certainly. But it can't be, you can't just pick on the poor guy that's trying to get a mortgage for a starter home and say that's where we're going to apply financial responsibility. It's got to be applied across the board. It's fine to apply it to that guy, but you've got to apply it to all the big shot investing advisors too. And the mutual funds. And the authors of the books and the you know, the Money Magazine and all this sort of thing. And the websites. When they're all reporting the effect of valuations on long-term returns, when they're all giving us accurate retirement numbers, then I think we'll have a better case for Rick Santelli saying we shouldn't be helping people with their mortgages. That's a different story. My real point in all this is, well, the one point was that sentence. I don't think I can recall it now exactly, but that sentence about cars for the long run, when I said the whole car selling industry breaks down if customers stop caring about price. Our entire free market system breaks down if stock investors don't care about price. You must care about price. It's a public policy requirement. We can't survive as a nation if we train people not to care about the price of the stocks they buy. It cannot work. It's not that the free market has failed exactly. It's that the market is not free. So long as you're appealing to people's most base emotions, we should be offering rational investing advice, not passive investing advice. The whole reason why a free market works is because of the feedback mechanisms. It's because information bits are being exchanged and producers are learning what consumers want and meeting their needs. And when you tell people to invest passively, you're telling them, send false information bits. Don't analyze value propositions. And when the customers stop analyzing value propositions, they're buying bad stuff. They're sending the wrong message. They're saying, give us more of this bad stuff. We love it. And the market gets more and more and more corrupted. And in today's world, there are too many people invested in the stock market. Most middle class workers are invested in some way in the stock market through their 401k plans. It eats the entire economy, given enough time. This is, in my belief, this is the only explanation of our economic crisis big enough. All of these other explanations you're hearing, that the fault is with the bankers or with Bernie Madoff or with Freddie Mac or whatever it is, are petty. They look at pieces of the problem. The real problem is systemic. The problem is the environment in which Freddie Mac existed, and the environment in which the bankers had to do business, and the environment in which Bernie Madoff sold his fund, and the environment in which the SEC was regulating, and the environment in which George Bush was running for office, and the environment in which Barack Obama drafted his stimulus plan. We've got to change that environment. We've got to change it from a passive environment to a rational environment. From a emotional environment to an environment, a reality principle environment. An environment where we're appealing to people's most base emotions, to an environment where we are encouraging people to be prudent about their own financial affairs and to be caring about the financial affairs of their community members. It's the difference between night and day. It's not about finding bad guys and fingering them. That's not the answer. Including the promoters of passive investing, because these people didn't promote it. Just like I said in my car illustration, the people who came up with these ideas, they probably had doubts. I've seen evidence that they've had doubts, lots of doubts. But if they don't sell passive investing, they're out of business. So there probably are some who refuse to do it. You've just never heard about them. They were buried years ago. Once you allow, there's a saying, bad currency drives out good. Bad investing advice drives out good. good investing advice cannot survive in a world in which passive investing has become dominant. And financial responsibility becomes a thing of the past. In a society in which passive / emotional investing becomes popular. We can turn it around, but we can't turn it around until we first start talking about the real issue, the real problem before us. I'd love to hear, I always love to hear your comments, but this is a particularly controversial podcast, so I'd especially love to hear your comments on this one. If you are willing to take some time out of your day to send me some thoughts, go to the website, passionsaving.com. Go to the left side of any page and look at the bottom, and you'll see a Contact Rob button. I'd like to hear from you whether you have encouraging things to say or criticisms to put forward. I can learn from either one. And if I got something wrong, please. If you got something wrong or if there's something on which you think I was unfair, those are the things where I really need the community to step in and to try to help get me back on track. So if you think I've been unfair or you think I've gotten something factually wrong, please do let me know. Please work with us to help overcome this passive investing problem if you can find it in your heart to do so. And in exchange, you know, we'll work to give you the advice you need to, help in your investing endeavors. This is a community. It's not one guy standing in the front of a classroom lecturing people. I learn from you and you learn from me. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.